panel discussion on the very interesting subject discussed in these two modules. I appreciate that the questions of the audience as well as the answers of the panelists be direct and short as possible. I invite you all here. Thank you. I think that the first question that comes here is for Nadia. How does the LC-NMS perform with protein-bound metabolites? Do you understand?
Can you repeat that question one more time?
Yeah. How does the LC-MS perform with protein-bound metabolites?
How it's performed with protein-bound? Oh, okay. So this is something that needs to happen before you put these samples on the instrument. You have to do some strategies to separate the protein bounds from the freely soluble. So you would do some sort of filtration and then get the freely solubles in the filtrate, and then you extract the protein bound ceramic toxins. It's a sample preparation procedure that has to happen up front.
Mm-hmm. This is another question. This is for Dr. McCausland and probably for Simon too. He says, do you think that the difference of sodium that the diffuse sodium gradient can, have a role regarding intradialytic symptoms?
So
the infusion.
So I think that kind of comes back to, you know, the dialysis sodium concentration and what's actually delivered. There's certainly, you know, a lot of evidence to suggest that symptoms are reduced or minimized with the use of higher dialysis sodium. So I think if that's your question, I think that evidence is there. I think a lot of this kind of comes down to the balance of what you're trying to achieve. And this may vary and differ from patient to patient. So for patients who are extremely symptomatic, you know, we might want to think about alterations that will minimize their symptoms. For patients who are less symptomatic but come in with like severe hypertension or volume overload, we may take a different strategy for those patients. And so until there's kind of clearer evidence, I think we're kind of stuck in terms of what to do with the dialysis sodium. But I would urge regular check-ins with your patients.
Okay, thank you.
Just like to add one thing. So based on the data that we observe from HEMO, there's also this notion that maybe not all symptoms are determined the same way by the predictors. What we saw is that, you know, symptoms were clustering by their, pathophysiology. Pain symptoms were more determined by different predictors than symptoms like lightheadedness or cramping, for instance. So this goes back to this notion of precision medicine applied to this field of patient-centered outcomes. I don't know, what do you think, Finian, that sodium may or may not be that relevant for a given symptom based on what we saw?
Yeah, it's hard to know, and I think it's the general description of hyponatremia and dialysis. You know, is it a marker or is it a player? And, you know, certainly any study that I've seen in any walk of medicine, hyponatremia has been associated with bad outcomes, and that's consistent in hemodialysis as well. What we found actually interesting is that when we did, another analysis of the HEMO study, hyponatremia appears to be associated with hypotension as opposed to hyper. And so, again, is the hyponatremium, the low serum sodium, simply a marker of some kind of impairment in cardiovascular activity or ejection fraction or something else? So I think overall, I think I would be reluctant to delve too much into sodium being pathophysiological, but perhaps more of a marker of some kind of other systemic complications or comorbidities.
Why do you think, Dr. McCausland, that there's so much difficulty trying to achieve that the sodium concentration in the dialysate must be equal to the plasma concentration of sodium? Why do you think that's so difficult?
But there's a few problems with it. A lot of it really comes down to the level of precision of your prescribed versus your delivered dialysate sodium. And at every step of the way, there's a certain margin of error as you make the dialysate to deliver it. And a lot of the dialysis machines monitor the conductivity as opposed to the true dialysate sodium concentration. And so within that conductivity, there is a margin of error as well. And so if your dialysate sodium, if your dialysate concentration falls within that margin of error, the machine will let it go. But that could be plus or minus what you actually want prescribed.
The change in the concentration of the dialysate, that's the problem. The way we try to maintain, let's say, 138 or 140 milligrams per liter, that's the problem.
Yeah, so I mean, it's important not to get too far ahead of ourselves based off one study of four centers and 300 or so patients, 300 or so treatments. But, I think given that there was such a wide range of difference of like plus or minus 2 millimoles per liter, it's very hard to talk about individualizing anything when you've got such a wide range.
One thing that is very important about sodium is that sodium is a constant in patients. You follow the sodium in one patient for a year, probably the change in milliequivalents at the end of 12 months is no more than 1 or 2 milliequivalents. Do you agree with that?
And there's all this theory about a sodium set point.
The set point of sodium is very constant.
Yep.
So if you have sodium every month, let's say for 3 months, you can have a ratio of what is going to happen in the following 12 months, and then at that moment you can achieve this difference. Of course, you have what we do in our dialysis unit is to maintain 138 plus minus 2, and that's the changes that you can pose. And most of our patients have all around that kind of sodium.
Yeah. I think anyway. Two points. One is that I think the sodium set point, at least in theory, is based on a steady state. Right, so that you're assuming that not really much changes with your patients. I think that is not true in maintenance dialysis patients who have excessive rates of mortality, repeated episodes of hypotension, changes in cardiovascular functioning, and so I'm not sure that we can extrapolate from the general population to the dialysis population in terms of sodium stability. Number one, and then the second point is that I worry that we are kind of missing where we're going a little bit because. At least based off the physiology, it's probably the osmolality in terms of blood pressure that's more important from a neurohormonal point of view than what the sodium is. Because again, if you think about what contributes to osmolality, it's mostly sodium, BUN, and glucose. And so there's lots of different things that are important, not just the sodium. So I worry that we're focusing too much on the sodium.
Now, for Dr. Pickelbauer, I am interested, the question is... you think that fibrosis is the main problem, and in those patients with diabetic nephropathy, that is changed by the use of SGLT2 blocking.
So this would be the concept behind it. We have not shown this in our data, but it has been shown before that the factors we see that we can influence with the SGLT2 inhibition. They are downregulated, and those players are involved in kidney fibrosis. So it has not been demonstrated that SGLT2 inhibition really reduces fibrosis, but this is the next step we should look into if this is possible. We see that the mediators of fibrosis are downregulated.
What do you think is the future of these investigations that you started with?
So the interesting thing is that we have clinical data for the efficacy of this SGLT2 inhibition, but we don't have the experimental data supporting that at first. So now we are getting these data after these trials have come out, which is quite unique, I think.
Yes.
So we will go into histology and so on. And
because we know that SGLT2 inhibition in the patient, of course, reduces the tendency to kidney progress of the nephropathy, but we suggested it was suggested originally that it was just hemodynamic changes because of the changes of the macula densa and the following of so much glucose and sodium at the macula densa and then the afferent artery all dilated and that was coming down there
like the RAS inhibition.
But now. There's this point that you're making is very important because they say that even though no changes in glucose concentration or anything, even though the patients improve. So this is why it is important, this paper, because this improves through less fibrosis in the kidney.
We have to demonstrate this first, but yeah.
Yes. Now, there's another question for Nadia. Well, there are several questions for Nadia. You see, how do you practically conduct metabolomic studies? Aren't the cost prohibitive? Well, you comment on that, but anyway, you can comment further. How can statistically statistically changes with so much data, and how artificial intelligence once be used to interpret metabolomic data? So you need artificial intelligence.
Stefana, can you repeat the last question? I didn't understand.
Excuse me?
The last question was...
Yeah, the question is, has artificial intelligence can be used to interpret metabolomic data? To interpret metabolomic data because of the amount of data that you have.
Mm-hmm. Like statistical approaches and things?
Yes. But that happens also with the genetic data, so it's the same.
So similar approaches are used in metabolomics.
And, yes.
The companies that produce those aspects now are invested really in helping researchers to go through their data and do some feature recognition and also pre-filter the results so that eventually with the software that the vendors provide plus open source software, you can really look into all kinds of relationships and associations. And there are also ways to integrate clinical data to all the different changes that you see in your metabolomic data. I have to admit that my strength is really in providing data and making sure that everything is reproducible and having very low standard deviations and things like that. And then I would probably refer these questions to our more experienced data analysts that have a lot of... they already are very knowledgeable about statistical analyses of those things. So we will definitely use our expertise at the RRI with dealing with these huge data sets and this kind of big data and collaborate among different fields.
For Diana, what do you think is the role of hypoxemia in all these intradialytic complications and post-dialytic complications? Do you think it's very important to maintain a good oxygen concentration and that we have to use more these type of measures that we don't use usually? In many places, we don't use it at all. The concentration, the oxygen concentration. What do you think about that?
Use more what? I'm sorry.
Yes. What do you think of if the hypoxemia produces... What's the role of hypoxemia in the production of all these problems of complications, intradialytic complications and post-dialytic complications that may be related to low oxygen concentration? What do you think about that?
Okay, hypoxemia has been related with increased mortality in patients in hemodialysis. And I think it's important to explore these changes, but the impact of intradialytic hypoxemia is the question.
Yes, well, but it's happening. That's what you describe, no?
In intradialytic
you describe that. I'm just extrapolating that to the complications. For instance, Simon, what do you think of hypoxemia and the presence of all the symptoms that you describe on your excellent presentation? What do you think about oxygen concentration?
So, and this is in relationship to symptoms or to heart outcomes, though? that you ask?
Because we know that along the dialysis, hypoxemia develops. But she presented a lot of information about that. What do you think about, I don't know, hypotension, lightheadedness, anything?
I think there's a big matrix of data and confounders, speaking in particular about the symptoms. From our data, we did not particularly explore hypoxemia, although I think that hypoxemia could mediate some of the symptoms and also some of the harder outcomes. I'm not sure about the totality of the data there, but thinking of pain symptoms, such as chest pain, which we explore, I think that there's definitely some hyperperfusion, hypoxemia mediation for these symptoms. Whether or not they're associated with harder outcomes, I think that remains to be answered. Looking at previous works, for instance, Flight's papers on intradilated hypotension, the definitions that incorporate symptoms have failed to demonstrate an association with harder outcomes. So I think it's still an answer that we don't have the answer yet. But it definitely, I'm sure there's some implication in the symptom biology.
I think it's not the hypoxemia per se. Maybe the changes that occurs, the changes in blood flow and blood flow out of the upper body or in the myocardial stoning, and these changes causes intradialytic hypoxemia. And maybe these changes are related with the symptoms, with the cramps, with symptoms related with hypotension.
Yeah. I agree, yes. Yeah. What do you think, Dr. McCausland? Do you have an opinion on that?
I think it's hard to know. I mean, I suppose I always look for a reference, and I don't know the exercise physiology that well, but I'd be interested what happens, you know, the central oxygen saturations when you exercise in a normal individual. How different is that from a dialysis patient? I don't know what the answer to that is. Because if it drops as well, maybe it's not so different than a dialysis patient. So I think having another kind of non-dialysis reference would be extremely important before we extrapolate too much further.
Yes. Listen, another question or not? I think we can. Thank you very much to the panelists.